Rolling Stone, wanna see our pictures on the cover. Stone, wanna buy 5 copies for our mother. Stone, wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we're reading from a special collector's edition of Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan, The Complete Album Guide. In our last session, we reviewed the first 6 albums that had been released by Bob Dylan. That covered the period up through 1966. As a child of the 60s, it brought back a flood of memories for me, and I hope it did for you as well. We begin today with an album released in December of 1967, John Wesley Harding. This review by Simon Vozick Levinson. A year after his motorcycle accident, Dylan made a radical turn toward a new simplicity. In the autumn of 1967, Bob Dylan took a mysterious trip to Nashville. As I recall, it was just on a kind of whim that Bob went down. Robbie Robertson, who had spent much of that summer woodshedding with Dylan and the rest of the band in upstate New York, would later say. To this day, no one knows for sure when Dylan wrote many of the 12 songs he recorded on his secretive visit. He hadn't played a single one of them during his mythic sessions in the basement of Big Pink near Woodstock that year, and he reputedly composed several of the best new tunes, The Ballad of Frankie Lee and Judas Priest, I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, and Drifter's Escape, during his 2-day train ride from New York to Nashville. Once there, he knocked out his 8th album in just 3 sessions in a local studio. "We did the whole thing in 9.5 hours, says Charlie McCoy, who returned from the Blonde on Blonde sessions to play bass on the new material. He was focused, and he never used a lyric sheet. To memorize those lyrics with all those double meanings was impressive." John Wesley Harding came as a shock to fans, and decades later, it stands alone in Dylan's discography. A hard pivot away from the revolutionary rock and roll masterpieces that preceded, and equally distant from anything else he'd done or would do. Its tightly crafted country folk songs lack traditional choruses, but teem with cryptic tales and strange warnings. "There was to be no wasted language, no wasted breath," Allen Ginsberg later said of the approach to songwriting that Dylan adopted after Blonde on Blonde. All the imagery was to be functional rather than ornamental. Dylan himself traced the change to his 1966 motorcycle crash. "I thought I was just going to get up and go back to doing what I was doing before," he recalled in 1969. "But I couldn't do it anymore." Dylan began incorporating explicit religious language into his lyrics. Much has been made of Beatty Zimmerman's report around this time that her son kept a huge Bible open on a stand in the middle of his study. The death of Dylan's early idol, Woody Guthrie, on October 3, 1967, less than a month before recording began, may well have influenced songs like I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, a surreal riff on the labor rally folk standard, Joe Hill. The sound of the album was bracingly austere, which Dylan later explained as a reaction to the very indulgent psychedelic orchestration of albums like The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Casting aside his own ambitious arrangements on the previous year's Blonde on Blonde, he called back only 2 of his sidemen from that album, McCoy on bass and Kenny Buttrey on drums, and kept his interactions with them at a bare minimum. "He didn't talk to us, which was unusual," McCoy says. "Just did not communicate. I think he appreciated what we were doing. It was hard to tell." It was a stark shift away from the late-night carnival atmosphere of the Blonde on Blonde sessions, but as the songs made clear, that Dylan was long gone. Dylan's next album was Nashville Skyline, released in April of 1969. This review is once again by Simon Vozick Levinson. Dylan jammed with Johnny Cash and crooned like Caruso for his most blissed-out album. In June 1969, 2 months after Nashville Skyline landed in stores, Dylan told Rolling Stone founder Jan S. Wenner that he'd originally had a different name in mind for his latest album, The title came up, John Wesley Harding, Volume 2, he said. We were going to do that. As usual, Dylan must have been at least partly kidding. Nashville Skyline was recorded in the same city as its 1967 predecessor and re-enlisted its rhythm section, but that's where the similarities end. Where John Wesley Harding was an ominous riddle, Nashville Skyline was a big warm hug, from its All Smiles cover photo to the sweet romantic love songs on its track list. The record company wanted to call the album Love Is All There Is, Dylan said. It sounded a little spooky to me. He'd been flirting with country music for a few years, but this is the album where Dylan fully embraced the influence of Hank Williams, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis Presley. The sound was Nashville, and I was so glad, says Charlie McCoy, who played bass on the album. He and drummer Kenny Buttrey were joined by other top Music City session players, including guitarist Charlie Daniels and pedal steel master Pete Drake, for a colorful full band sound. We just take a song, Dylan said of the laid-back sessions. I play it, and everyone else sort of fills in behind. Dylan claimed cutting out smoking was all it took to unlock the surprising baritone croon he debuted on the LP. I tell you, you stop smoking these cigarettes, and you'll be able to sing like Caruso. Lay Lady Lay, a sexy ballad written for the film Midnight Cowboy, showcased his new voice over Drake's syrupy steel and Buttrey's syncopated rhythm. Years later, Buttrey recalled nailing his part with the use of a real cheap bongo set and a spare cowbell. Kris Kristofferson was working Columbia Studios at the time as a janitor, and he had just emptied my ashtray at the drums, Buttrey said. I said, Chris, do me a favor. Here, hold these two things. A few days after the initial sessions for Nashville Skyline, Dylan returned to the studio with his buddy Johnny Cash. Together, they recorded upward of a dozen loose covers, from You Are My Sunshine to the Appalachian folk standard Good Old Mountain Dew to Cash's own I Walk the Line and Ring of Fire. Only one made the album, a friendly duet on Dylan's Girl from the North Country, sounding like a milestone to show how far its author had traveled since the song's first appearance on 1963's The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. It almost served another purpose, too. Some of the names for the album just didn't seem to fit, Dylan said, laughing in that 1969 interview. Picture me on the front holding a guitar and Girl from the North Country printed on top. Dylan's next album, released in June of 1970, was entitled Self-Portrait, and this review is by Andy Green. Dylan's weirdest album was full of covers and cheesy strings, but a great record lurked inside all along. In the spring of 1970, anticipation for Dylan's next album was through the roof. He hadn't released a note of new music since Nashville Skyline 14 months earlier. His upcoming album was going to be his first double LP since Blonde on Blonde, and it came with a title, Self-Portrait, that seemed to promise the kind of personal statement fans craved. What they got was something totally different. A radio station played the entire record when it first came out, says author and critic Grail Marcus. Maybe a quarter of the way through, I recall the DJ saying, Gee, I don't know if I should keep playing this. I've been getting a lot of phone calls saying, in essence, what is this shit? Those four words, what is this shit, kicked off Marcus's infamous review of Self-Portrait in Rolling Stone. He wasn't the only listener to be completely baffled by the album. It's a bizarre mishmash of pop covers, Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer, pre-rock hits, Blue Moon, and poorly recorded live cuts from Dylan's 1969 set at the Isle of Wight Festival. Nearly every tune is overloaded with backup choirs, strings, and horns. I knew that opening to the album review was provocative, Marcus says, but that's what everybody in the country was saying, and I had to reflect that. Dylan's journey to the first critical flop of his career started at Nashville's Studio A in April 1969, working with a band that included guitarist Charlie Daniels, bassist Charlie McCoy and drummer Kenny Buttry. He cut standards like A Fool Such As I and I Forgot More Than You'll Ever Know. Dylan didn't explain the thought process behind all the covers, and he still hasn't, though his decision to record Ring of Fire and Folsom Prison Blues was clearly inspired by an appearance on the Johnny Cash Show that week. The self-portrait sessions were extremely loose. There was nothing regimented, says Daniel. I remember one time he wanted me to do a solo. Someone said, how many bars? What chords? Dylan then made a very Dylan-esque statement. What do you want Daniels to play? Well, all he can. That was it. You just added what you thought was best and what you thought Bob wanted. After cutting just 11 songs, Dylan suspended the sessions until the following March. When they resumed in New York, his band included Al Kooper on the organ and David Bromberg on guitar, dobro, and bass. I hadn't played with him since Blonde on Blonde, so I was glad to get the call, says Cooper. When I got to the studio, it got really weird. Just the strangest situation. He had a pile of issues of Folk Music Journal Sing Out and was going through them, picking out songs and just recording them. They ran the gamut from traditional folk songs to Mr. Bojangles and Come a Little Bit Closer by Jay and the Americans and Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer. I didn't comprehend what he was doing, and I wasn't really in charge, so I just sat in my seat and did what I was told. Bromberg barely knew Dylan and had never worked with him. I tried to make the tracks interesting without overshadowing him, he said. With Bob, everything is either the first or second take. You either get it or you don't, and he always gets it. Also, he's an incomparable performer of traditional music. After the first album, he really lost touch with that side of himself. I think he just wanted to show different things that he was quite good at. Over three consecutive days, Dylan and his band cut 30 tracks, including traditional songs like Pretty Sarah and In Search of Little Sadie. Producer Bob Johnston then took all of the self-portrait tapes to Nashville without Dylan and piled on layers of horns, strings, and backup singers, dramatically altering the mellow sound of the originals and causing many critics to presume that Dylan had lost his mind. Johnston's motives for the gaudy overdubs remain unclear. So what exactly was this shit? As years went by, Dylan offered wildly different explanations for self-portrait. There's a lot of damn good music there, he told biographer Anthony Scaduto in 1971. People just didn't listen at first. But 3 years later, he began to admit that the album may not have been his finest hour. I didn't live with those songs for too long, he told Rolling Stone's Ben Fong Torres. Those were just scraped together. At a 1981 press conference, Dylan went further, calling the album a joke and saying that he tanked it on purpose, a position he explained in great detail in a 1984 interview with Rolling Stone. He was tired of hippies stalking him and his family in New York, overzealous followers who hoped Dylan would again become a leader of the protest movement. I said, well, fuck it. I wish these people would just forget about me, he told Kurt Loder. I want to do something they can't possibly like, they can't relate to. They'll see it, and they'll listen, and they'll say, well, let's go on to the next person. He ain't saying it no more. He ain't giving us what we want, you know? It didn't go as planned. The whole idea backfired, he said, because the album went out there and the people said, this ain't what we want, and they got more resentful. And then I did this portrait for the cover. I did the cover in about 5 minutes. And I said, well, I'm going to call this album Self-Portrait. In 1985, he said the album was a response to the Dylan bootlegs that had flooded the market. I just figured I'd put all this stuff together and put out my own bootleg record, so to speak, he said. You know, if it actually had been a bootleg record, people probably would have sneaked around to buy it and played it for each other secretly. Dylan is a notoriously unreliable narrator of his own life story, so it's impossible to say what his true intentions were. But 43 years after the album's release, he allowed his team to revisit the original session tapes, minus the overdubs, and release it as the Revelatory Bootleg Series box set, Another Self-Portrait. The results were stunning, proving that underneath Johnston's overdubs sat a beautiful covers album. The unadulterated self-portrait songs were very stark and arresting, says Marcus. Without the additional stuff and overdubs, the music speaks an entirely different language. The deluxe Another Self-Portrait also included Dylan's complete set at the Isle of Wight, his first major performance since his motorcycle crash 3 years earlier. A new mix of the live recording lowered the vocals and proved his uneven performance was not nearly as bad as the legend suggested. The new set did cause Marcus to reassess this period of Dylan's career, but he stands by his review of the original Self-Portrait. A few years ago, Mojo asked me to come back and listen to the record again and write about it again, he says. I tried really hard to listen to it and hear where I might have been wrong. The stuff that I liked before sounded even better. The stuff that I didn't like before, like the Everly Brothers' Let It Be Me, was worse. I don't know why he released the version he did. Maybe it was meant to be a moat to keep people away. In October of 1970, Dylan released New Morning, this review by John Dolan. Dylan bounced back from Self-Portrait with a sentimental album. Self-Portrait was Bob Dylan's first commercial and critical calamity. In some ways, its follow-up, New Morning, was his first return to form. The heavy-handed overdubs and strings were gone. The songs, all newly written originals, were warm and simple, often dealing with basic themes like love, family, and faith. "We've got Dylan back again," exclaimed a banner headline in Rolling Stone. In fact, some assumed that Dylan had rush-released New Morning, which arrived only 4 months after Self-Portrait, in a hurried response to its predecessor's baleful reception, a suggestion Dylan rejected. "I didn't say, 'Oh my God, they don't like this, let me do another one,'" he said in 1975. Sessions for what would become New Morning began in New York in early 1970, shortly after Self-Portrait had been completed. "He took things from the Self-Portrait era and added them to New Morning," says Al Cooper, who produced part of the album. That May, George Harrison joined Dylan in the studio, along with drummer Russ Kunkel and Charlie Daniels on bass. "One of my favorite days that I ever had in music," Daniels recalls. "It was so loose." Later that year, a version of New Morning's lovely opening song, If Not For You, would end up on Harrison's triple album, All Things Must Pass. The looseness fit the casual feel of songs like Went to See the Gypsy, which has been interpreted as Dylan's recollection of a meeting with Elvis Presley. In fact, the two had never met. And The Man and Me, which reflected Dylan's marital contentment at the time. Guitarist Ron Cornelius later recalled, "When you were around him and Sarah and the kids, you envied the great family feel this guy had." Even when he tangled with his public persona, Dylan did it with offhanded wit. Day of the Locusts recounted a trip to Princeton in June 1970 to receive an honorary degree. Upon arriving with his wife Sarah and David Crosby, Dylan sat nervously through the ceremony next to a very stoned Crosby. At one point, a swarm of droning locusts descended upon the grounds, delivering a, quote, sweet melody, unquote, more interesting to Dylan than any remarks delivered at the podium. New Morning ends with Father of Night, Dylan's interpretation of a Jewish prayer. It was one of several songs on the album originally written for a play by Archibald MacLeish that Dylan had backed out of. MacLeish found Dylan's songs too light, and while Dylan knew some might dismiss New Morning as sentimental, he didn't care. As he wrote years later in Chronicles, "My family was my life." The next album, released in July 1973, was a first for Dylan, a soundtrack entitled Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, this review by Andy Green. The ill-fated soundtrack that gave Dylan one of his most enduring hits. In late 1972, novelist Rudy Wurlitzer invited Bob Dylan down to Durango, Mexico, and the set of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, a Western for which Wurlitzer had written the screenplay. Tired of his obsessive, prying fans, Dylan leapt at the chance to take his family out of the country. Wurlitzer wanted Dylan to contribute music to the soundtrack, but director Sam Peckinpah didn't know who the singer was. When Dylan sat on a stool and played a new song called Billy on acoustic guitar, Peckinpah exclaimed, "Who is that kid? Sign him up!" Dylan was put in charge of the soundtrack and was asked to play the mysterious drifter Alias, despite his total lack of acting experience. The shoot was long, over budget, and incredibly strained. "My wife got fed up almost immediately," Dylan said in 1985. "She'd say to me, 'What the hell are we doing here?'" It was not an easy question to answer. Work on the soundtrack began midway through filming during a chaotic, all-night, vodka and weed-infused session at a Mexico City studio, where the musicians on hand included a group of local horn players and country singer Chris Christopherson. Billy Four, one of the soundtrack's three Billy songs, was the only salvageable song from the evening. When filming wrapped in early 1973, Dylan booked 2 days at Burbank Studios in California to cut the rest of the soundtrack. Dylan, drummer Jay Keltner, and Byrd's frontman Roger McGuinn recorded the instrumentals that served as the film's score, playing along to scenes projected on the screen. "There was a little green line that went across the film that shows you where to start and stop playing," McGuinn recalls. The only song to have lyrics other than the various Billy tunes was "Knockin' on Heaven's Door." "I just loved the song right away," McGuinn says. He wasn't alone. "Knockin' on Heaven's Door" gave Dylan a much-needed hit and a live favorite for decades to come. Still, critics savaged the finished album. In Rolling Stone, John Landau wrote, "The most significant white rock figure of the 60s has turned himself into one of the least significant of the 70s. Dylan's next album, which was released in January of 1974, was Planet Waves. This review is by Douglas Woke, who calls it a quickie album recorded with the band that went to number one and nudged Dylan back into public life. In late 1973, after years of isolation, Dylan planned his return to the road on his own terms. "I'm not looking to be that new messiah," he said at the time. "That's not in the cards for me. That's all over. That's the past." It had been 7 years since his last tour, the apocalyptic shows in 1965 and 66 with the band, that drew a line in the sand with his old audience. Dylan's last studio album was 1970's New Morning. Since then, he'd recorded a few songs for his second greatest hits collection and the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid soundtrack, but not much more. He'd also parted ways with Columbia Records, where he'd recorded since 1961. And was living part-time in California. Dylan approached his return to public life with characteristic ambivalence. "Now that it's happened, it pleases me," he said. "But if it hadn't happened, it wouldn't have disappointed me either." To back him on the tour this time out, Dylan chose the band, who were essentially the only road band he'd ever had. Since their first tours and time together in Woodstock recording the Basement tapes, the band had gone on to become rock stars themselves, and the announcement of a 6-week Dylan band tour in early 1974 yielded 5.5 million applications for tickets. David Geffen, owner of Asylum Records, persuaded Dylan that it would be a good idea to cut a new album in time for the tour, and they made a handshake deal for Asylum to release it. In response, his old label, Columbia, released the wretched outtakes collection Dylan, still considered the worst Dylan release of all times. Dylan and most of the band began work at the Village Recorder in Los Angeles on November 2, 1973. Drummer LeVon Helm arrived a few days later. The sessions were overseen by engineer Rob Fraboni, who had recently worked on the Rolling Stones' Goat's Head Soup. Fraboni recalls that the first day in the studio was devoted to warm-ups and covers like House of the Rising Sun, although the group also recorded the version of Never Say Goodbye that ended up on Planet Waves. The outtake, Nobody Cept You, eventually released on the Bootleg series, volumes 1-3, and an embryonic version of a song called Forever Young, that Dylan said he'd had in mind for 5 years. I wrote it thinking about one of my boys and not wanting to be too sentimental, Dylan said in the liner notes in Biograph. The session was cut short so the group could watch the TV special Barbara Streisand and Other Musical Instruments, but Dylan advised Fraboni to keep the tape rolling even while the show was on. You never know what somebody might say. The three original songs they recorded that first day were apparently the only ones Dylan had yet written for the album. By the time of the next session, 3 days later, he had a fresh batch of material, including You, Angel, You, Going, Going, Gone, and Something There Is About You. The Planet Waves songs, as the band's Robbie Robertson later argued, were as simple as Dylan had ever done, relaxed and upbeat. The band didn't even need to rehearse, according to Fraboni. They had nothing written down, no chord charts, no lyrics, no nothing. Those guys were just watching Bob's hands, and they'd get those songs even on a first take. It was just remarkable. Robertson, discussing the sessions in 1976, was more sanguine. We know the technique very well. We've been playing with Bob for years. There's no surprises involved. Most of the album was complete within a week, all of it cut live in the studio except for a small vocal overdub on Going, Going, Gone. Dylan, at this point, was still recording his lead vocals at the same time as instrumental tracks, already an old-fashioned way of doing things in 1973. We all loved the way Bob really wanted to sing the songs, only once a day, one rendition a day, Garth Hudson told Dylan biographer Howard Soames. So we'd often get the song on the first take. There may have been some second takes there. When Dylan and Fraboni met at the studio to assemble a reel of master takes, Fraboni pulled up a majestic slow version of Forever Young that they'd recorded the previous day with conga player Ken Lauber. Dylan informed him that it wouldn't be going on the album, since a friend's girlfriend had heard the recording and accused him of getting mushy. Fraboni was convinced it was one of their best songs and flatly told Dylan, "If we don't use that, I quit right now." Dylan relented, but he wasn't quite done yet. While the master reel was being assembled, Fraboni says, Dylan was lying on his back with a legal pad and a flare pen, writing furiously. He says to me, "Listen, I want to record a song. Is that okay?" I set up a couple of mics in the studio. He sits there and just starts to play the song, and it's Wedding Song, the recording that ended up as the final track on Planet Waves. He'd just written. He hadn't picked up a guitar to go through the chord changes or anything. It just goes to show you how his mind works. The rattling sounds on the recording are the deer antler buttons on Dylan's new jacket hitting the back of his guitar. After one more recording session, the album, first titled Love Songs, and then Ceremonies of the Horsemen, after a line from Love Minus Zero, No Limit, was rushed to Asylum to get it into stores in time for the start of the tour at the beginning of 1974, and then delayed when Dylan abruptly decided to resequence and retitle it. The released version featured cover artwork by Dylan himself. He also wrote rambling text on the back cover, which was removed from later editions of the album. Planet Waves reflected Dylan's guarded reemergence as a performer. "I've paid the price of solitude, but at least I'm out of debt," he sang on Dirge, one of the album's many autobiographical songs. It also deepened the sense of domestic tranquility he'd explored on New Morning, from lighthearted tunes such as On a Night Like This and You, Angel, You, to the acoustic ballad Wedding Song. Released several weeks into the tour, Planet Waves became his first number one album, leaping from number 19 to the top of the charts in its second week, seeming to reaffirm Dylan's commercial prestige. Critical response was positive, too, though Patti Smith, reviewing the record, noted that, "The band makes me nervous, like a bumblebee in your face." But its sales dropped off quickly, and Forever Young was the only song from Planet Waves that stayed in Dylan's set for the rest of the six-week tour. By 1978, he was introducing Going, Going, Gone by dismissing the record it was part of. This is off our album called Planet Waves, sold about 4 copies. We're about halfway through the Dylan anthology, and this is a tribute written by Bono called Voice of Ages, celebrating a revolutionary vocalist who busted through the artifice and got to the art. This is from Rolling Stone of November 2008. Bob Dylan did what very, very few singers ever do. He changed popular singing, and we've been living in a world shaped by Dylan's singing ever since. Almost no one sings like Elvis Presley anymore. Hundreds try to sing like Dylan. When Sam Cooke played Dylan for the young Bobby Womack, Womack said he didn't understand it. Cooke explained that from now on, it's not going to be about how pretty the voice is. It's going to be about believing that the voice is telling the truth. To understand Bob Dylan's impact as a singer, you have to imagine a world without Tom Waits, Bruce Springsteen, Eddie Vedder, Kurt Cobain, Lucinda Williams, or any other vocalist with a cracked voice, dirt bowl yelp, or bluesy street howl. It's a vast list, but so are the influences on Dylan. From the Talmudic chanting of Allen Ginsberg in Howl to the deadpan Woody Guthrie and Lefty Frizzell's murmur, there is certainly iron ore in there and the bitter cold of Hibbing, Minnesota blowing through that voice. It's like a knotted fist, and it allows Dylan to sing the most melancholy tunes and not succumb to sentimentality. What's interesting is that later, as he gets older, the fist opens up to a vulnerability. I've heard him sing versions of Idiot Wind, where he was definitely the idiot. I first heard Bob Dylan's voice in the dark when I was 13 years old on my friend's record player. It was his greatest hits album, the first one. The voice was at once modern, in all the things it was railing against, and very ancient. It felt strangely familiar to an Irishman. We thought America was full of superheroes. But it was a much humbler people in these songs. Farmers, people who've had great injustices done to them. The really unusual thing about Bob Dylan was that, for a moment in the 60s, he felt like the future. He was the voice of a generation, raised against the generation that came before. Then he became the voice of all the generations. Here are some adjectives I've found myself using to describe that voice. Howling, seducing, raging, indignant, jeering, imploring, begging, hectoring, confessing, keening, wailing, soothing, conversational, crooning. It's a voice like smoke from cigar to incense, where it's full of wonder and worship. There's a voice for every Dylan you can meet, and the reason I'm never bored of Bob Dylan is because there are so many of them, all centered on the idea of a pilgrimage. People forget that Bob Dylan had to warm up for Dr. King before he made his great I Have a Dream speech, the preacher preceded by the pilgrim. Dylan has tried out so many personas in his singing because it's the way he inhabits his subject matter. His closet won't close for all the shoes of the characters that walk through his stories. I love Shot of Love. There's no production. You're in a room hearing him sing. And I like a lot of the songs that he worked on with Daniel Lanois, Series of Dreams, Most of the Time. That is the period where he moves me most. The voice becomes the words. There is no performing, just life, as Yeats says, when the dancer becomes the dance. Dylan did with singing what Brando did with acting. He busted through the artifice to get to the art. Both of them tore down the prissy rules laid down by the school marms of their craft, broke through the fourth wall, got in the audience's face and said, "I dare you to think I'm kidding." Dylan's next release came in January of 1975, and Joe Levy reviews Blood on the Tracks. In the midst of a personal and artistic crisis, Dylan reinvented himself and made a masterpiece. In the spring of 1974, Dylan returned to Carnegie Hall, where he'd first played a small recital hall in 1961, just days after signing with Columbia. But it wasn't the music that brought him there. he'd come to study with Norman Rabin, a Russian-born painter and scholar of Judaism who taught in an 11th-floor studio above the hall. Dylan was in artistic crisis, though it should have been a moment of triumph. By February, he had his first number one album with Planet Waves and had mounted a massively successful 32-date arena tour with the band. But, as he'd later tell Rolling Stone's Jonathan Cott, he'd long felt he was fumbling for a way back to the wildfire of those early days. Right through the time of Blonde on Blonde, I was doing it unconsciously. Then one day I was half-stepping, and the lights went out. And since that point, I've more or less had amnesia. He'd sought out Rabin, the son of famed Yiddish writer Sholem Halachim, with the idea of learning more about Jewish philosophy, but ended up spending 2 months studying painting, 5 days a week from 8:30 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. With Rabin's help, Dylan would reinvent himself as a conscious artist. "He didn't teach you so much how to draw," Dylan said. "He taught you putting your head and mind and your eye together. He looked into you and told you what you were." Of particular importance were ideas about perspective and time. Dylan, who'd never seen things linearly, began to understand time from the multiple perspective of cubism and how to construct narratives that put yesterday, today, and tomorrow all in the same room. The first track on the resulting album would take its name from a critique Rabin made of Dylan's over-reliance on just one color in one of his canvases, Tangled Up in Blue. There were other tangles for Dylan besides the artistic. He was sorting out his business, negotiating his return to Columbia after releasing Planet Waves, and the live album Before the Flood on David Geffen's Asylum label. More important, Dylan's 12-year marriage to Sarah Lowndes was showing strain. Just before a February 11th show with the band in Oakland, he met a 24-year-old woman named Ellen Bernstein, who ran Columbia's San Francisco A&R office. The two left a party thrown by promoter Bill Graham and went to her house, where they stayed up all night playing backgammon. Bernstein was not sure she'd hear from Dylan again, but not long after, he asked her to spend time with him at his house in Malibu. And in the summer, he invited her to his farm in Minnesota, west of Minneapolis, along the Crow River. His brother, David Zimmerman, had a house in front by the road. In a house farther back, Dylan spent his mornings writing lyrics in a red notebook. Bernstein told Clinton Halen that Dylan would materialize around midday, come downstairs, and eventually, during the day, share what he had written. "It was in a notebook, but he would play it and ask me what I thought. And it was always different, every time. He would just change it and change it and change it." Many of these songs would never stop changing, shifting lyrics, characters, locales, and perspective, in performance and on record for years to come. As if Dylan wanted to offer instruction to his audience the way Rabin had given it to him. "It doesn't stop," Dylan told Paul Zollo in 1991 of the differing versions of Idiot Wind. "It's something that could be a work continually in progress." As some 17 songs filled the red notebook, Dylan began to hone his work further by playing it for friends coast to coast. On July 22nd, he performed 8 or 9 songs for Stephen Stills and bassist Tim Drummond in a hotel room after a Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young show in St. Paul. "We were on twin beds across from each other," Drummond told Rolling Stone. "Oh, God, I can't tell you how great it was." Stills was less impressed. After Dylan left, according to Graham Nash, Stills said, "He's a good songwriter, but he's no musician." In August, while staying with Bernstein in Oakland, Dylan played even more of Blood on the Tracks for Michael Bloomfield. 9 years before, Bloomfield had been taught some of the songs for Highway 61 Revisited by Dylan before the sessions. This was a different experience. Dylan played a steady stream of songs without pause, refusing to let Bloomfield tape them, and giving him no chance to learn the songs or follow along. "He just did it one after another, and I got lost," Bloomfield said. At that point, all the songs were in an open D tuning. "They all began to sound the same to me. They were all in the same key, and they were all long. It was one of the strangest experiences of my life. By September, Dylan and Bernstein were in New York, where the first sessions for the album would take place, but not before one more dry run. He wanted to go visit this friend of his in some Hasidic neighborhood. I think it was Crown Heights, Bernstein remembered. We went out in the backyard and he played the songs for these friends of his, this group of Hasidic Jews. In mid-September, Dylan was ready to record. The sessions began at A&R Studios in Midtown Manhattan, formerly Columbia Studio A, where Dylan had recorded his first six albums. On the afternoon of September 16th, Dylan met with producer Phil Ramone and played him the songs. The recordings Ramone made have never been bootlegged, and sources who've heard them describe them as raw, close to the bone, and virtually flawless, in some cases superior to the finished album takes, and without any of the complications that would ensue. Those complications began almost immediately. Ramone tapped Eric Weisberg, who could play most anything with strings, and who'd struck gold the year before when dueling banjos, which he'd recorded for the soundtrack to the movie Deliverance, went to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. At 6 p.m., Weisberg and the Deliverance band showed up to begin recording. They were accomplished session musicians and were immediately frustrated by the task of keeping up with Dylan, who'd once only half-jokingly described himself as a trapeze artist. Ramone didn't play them the solo takes he'd recorded earlier in the day, and there were no charts. Instead, Dylan would show them a song. They'd scramble to write down the chords, do a run-through, and then strain to watch Dylan's hands as he played, because he'd change the chords as he went. He wanted the immediacy of the moment. He didn't care if there were mistakes in there or not, guitarist Charlie Brown told writer Andy Gill. We, on the other hand, were used to getting it right. Not that night. For 6 hours until midnight, they worked on 30 takes of more than a half dozen songs. The full band tracks haven't been bootlegged, but those who've heard them describe a disappointing clash between the raw emotion of Dylan's material and the all-too-professional accompaniment. The following day, Dylan called back in bassist Tony Brown, without the rest of the Deliverance band. Brown was even more nervous arriving on his own, but he had a plan. He wanted to channel Charlie McCoy's driving but sympathetic work on John Wesley Harding, which he, like many others, believed was Dylan's last truly great album. Over the next 3 days, working with Brown, he would arrive at finished, if not final, versions of the cuts. That first night, with help from Paul Griffin, who'd played on Highway 61, on organ, they completed You're a Big Girl Now. The second, One-on-One, Dylan and Brown completed You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go and Shelter from the Storm. The third night, with Griffin back, they did 4 more songs, including Idiot Wind. On September 25th, Dylan left with a test pressing of Blood on the Tracks. As he had with the songs in the Red Notebook, he played it for others to gauge their reaction. One was his brother, David, when Dylan was back in Minneapolis in December. David, apparently struck by the starkness of the material, reignited Dylan's desire for fuller versions of the songs. David didn't believe they would get a lot of airplay or create any stir, says Kevin Odegaard today. Odegaard was then a local singer-songwriter managed by David. He'd met Dylan before several times. Our families were kind of close, he says. Odegaard earned his living as a brakeman on the railroad. On the Thursday night after Christmas, he got a call from David, who was looking for a particular guitar, a 1937 0042 Martin. As Odegaard tracked it down, the reason emerged over a series of conversations. Dylan would be recutting some material at a studio called Sound 80 in Minneapolis. The three other musicians who were tapped, keyboardist Greg Inhofer, bassist Billy Peterson, and drummer Billy Burr, leaned more jazz than folk. On December 27th, they joined Odegaard and Chris Weber, whose music store had the Martin guitar, at Sound 80. The reality of having Bob Dylan walk in the room was pretty shocking, says Odegaard. But what unfolded was easygoing. There are two Bobs, Bob Dylan the movie actor and Robert Zimmerman the Minnesota guy, who just hangs out. And that's who we got. Weber struck up a conversation with Dylan and was drafted to play guitar and teach the band the songs. They started with Idiot Wind, a markedly different, more acidic version than the New York Tick. "He was just on fire," says Odegaard. "A lot of that Highway 61 angry energy in the air." After four takes, Dylan listened to a playback and added that feeling by overdubbing himself on a Hammond B3 organ. A one-take version of "You're a Big Girl Now" followed, and work was done for the evening. Dylan was obviously pleased. A call went out for a Monday session, and things moved even faster. Odegaard remembers Dylan revising the songs from the Red Notebook throughout the night, writing lyrics on pink phone message slips. "He scribbled lyrics to the very last minute," Odegaard says, "and then he'd work with Chris in the booth and come out, and we'd do a song." First up was Tangled Up in Blue, which Odegaard thought was lifeless in the open detuning of the New York version. "It was just laying there," he says. "It was boring. I said, no, let's goose it. Let's move it up." They strummed through a version in A, and after seven or eight measures, Dylan gave the nod, and they cut it in one take. "Everybody just went quiet, including Bob," says Odegaard. "We looked at our shoes. It really did take your breath away." Lily, Rosemary, and the Jack of Hearts, and If You See Her, Say Hello, followed, each also in one take. Dylan knew exactly the sound he was after, and overdubbed guitar and mandolin on If You See Her. In about 8 hours of work over two nights, they had finished five songs. "Bob gushed about it in the parking lot afterward with Billy Peterson," says Odegaard. "You know what we did in there? You know how well we did in there? It was just great." Dylan had re-signed with Columbia, which had already begun to print covers for an album they thought had been finished in December. The new takes made the album, but not the credits, which have never been updated. It would be one of Dylan's greatest albums, and it would exist in a state of perpetual revision. The next album was Desire, released in January of 1976. Patrick Doyle reviews this album, an exotic album featuring a gangster, a boxer, and one of Dylan's most personal songs. Country singer Emmylou Harris had no idea what she was in for the day she arrived at Columbia Studios to sing backup on her first Dylan session. Harris had just received the lyrics to Romance in Durango and was practicing when she realized the tape had already started rolling. "I thought, oh, I can fix anything that sounds funky or out of tune with the engineer later," she says, but there would be no second takes. That album was like throwing paint on a canvas, and whatever happened was what was supposed to be. I guess that's another part of the genius of Dylan. He knew exactly what he was doing. Dylan thrived on chaos and chance while making Desire, a process that was a far cry from the heavily labored recording of Blood on the Tracks. One night, Dylan was walking around Greenwich Village and was approached by Jacques Levy, a playwright and director who had previously written songs with Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Dylan invited Levy to hang out that night at The Other End, a long-standing folky haunt. Later on, at Levy's apartment, they wrote Isis. He said these magic words, "I'd like you to write some stuff for me," Levy recalled before his death in 2004. They continued work at Dylan's summer home in the Hamptons, writing songs with a much different flavor than the reflective tone of his last album. "I guess I never intended to keep that going," Dylan said. "Sometimes you'll get what you can out of these things, but you can't stay there." Instead, these were sprawling narratives of outlaws and wanderers, with clearer storylines than anything Dylan had written in more than a decade. They included the cowboy on the run tale Isis and Joey, the 11-minute saga of fallen gangster Joey Gallo. "I thought Joey was a good song," Dylan said in 1981. "I know no one said much about it." Perhaps it was overshadowed by Hurricane, the story of former boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter, who had been convicted of a triple murder in 1966. "I read his book and it really touched me," said Dylan. "I felt that the man was innocent." though Dylan and Levy's lyrics were riddled with factual errors, as was Joey. The song helped turn public attention to Carter's case. His conviction was overturned in 1985. The album's atmosphere was also affected by a trip Dylan had taken to the south of France, where he had gone to a gypsy festival on his birthday. The gypsy imagery marked songs like One More Cup of Coffee and Durango. "I think exotic is a good word to put on it," said Levy. The only personal song on Desire is perhaps his most personal ever. Sarah, a plea to his then-estranged wife, Sarah Lowndes, to return to him. According to Levy, Lowndes showed up at the studio the night they recorded the song. "You could have heard a pin drop," said Levy. She was absolutely stunned by it. During recording, Dylan kept several studios going at once, filled with musicians including Dave Mason and Eric Clapton, and non-musicians, says bassist Rob Stoner. They had opened up all the adjacent studios to accommodate all these hangers-on and buffet tables. It was just like a huge party, and it wasn't conducive to getting any work done. Eventually, the rooms were cleared and a core group cut the entire album over two long nights. "There was just a level of excitement," says Stoner. Sessions were called for 7 p.m., and we only stopped at 7 in the morning because that's when they tow your car on the street. We didn't want to lose the vibe. No drinking, no drugs, no night. It was pure adrenaline. The next album was Street Legal, which was released in June of 1978, in which Dylan revamped his sound and asked some big questions. Street Legal was a strange mix of L.A. pop polish and the ramshackle gypsy busker vibe of Desire. Made in the wake of his protracted divorce, the album came across as the work of a man anxious to start afresh. According to band leader Rob Stoner, Dylan was always bummed out. He was chain-smoking, and he was really in a bad mood. Multi-instrumentalist David Mansfield recalled Dylan wanting new sounds. "I brought my steel guitar, and I had it in rehearsal. And every time I'd go to start unpacking it, Bob would go, 'We don't need that.'" The album was recorded quickly and mostly live in Dylan's Santa Monica rehearsal space. "I couldn't find the right producer," Dylan conceded, "but it was necessary to do it. So we just brought in the remote truck and cut it." In a later interview, he added, "It took us a week. We mixed it the following week and put it out the week after. If we hadn't done it that fast, we wouldn't have made an album at all, because we were ready to go back on the road." There are moments of magic on the set. "New Pony" is raw electric blues with R&B backing vocals and a shrieking sax. "Changing of the Guards" is an apocalyptic folk rocker with an arrangement recalling Van Morrison and early Springsteen, and mythic language about the marketplace and treacherous young witches that glints with autobiography. "It's a song that might have been there for thousands of years, sailing around in the midst," claimed Dylan, "and one day I just tuned into it." But the album highlight is Señor, Tales of Yankee Power, originally titled Armageddon, and which has the singer asking an inscrutable gentleman for answers to all sorts of questions. While Dylan has never said as much, the fact that El Señor is Spanish for the Lord suggests a turning point. "This place don't make sense to me no more," Dylan declares, imploring, "Can you tell me what we're waiting for, Señor?" The last album we're going to have time for today is Slow Train Coming. This released in August 1979. Andy Green writes, "The former Robert Zimmerman becomes a soldier for Christ." In 1978, Dylan was near the end of a grueling 115-date world tour, dubbed the Alimony Tour by critics, since he had just finalized a very costly divorce, when he experienced a life-changing event. "Jesus put his hand on me," he said. "It was a physical thing. I felt it. I felt it all over me. I felt my whole body tremble. The glory of the Lord knocked me down and picked me up." Fans noticed Dylan wearing a cross around his neck during the final shows that December, and offstage he was writing fiery songs about his religious transformation. At the tour's last stop, he debuted the explicitly evangelical "Do Right to Me, Baby, Do Unto Others." The songs kept coming as he began studying with the New Age Christian sect, the Vineyard Fellowship, after the tour. And by the time he called up legendary producer Jerry Wexler, the former Robert Allen Zimmerman had enough songs about the glory of Jesus that he was ready to put them on tape. Rehearsals for Slow Train Coming began near Dylan's house in Santa Monica, and when Wexler and keyboardist Barry Beckett arrived, they still didn't know what kind of album they were prepping. After a while, I said to Barry, "Well, it looks like we have wall-to-wall Jesus," Wexler said years later. Wexler suggested they record at Muscle Shoals Sound Studio in Sheffield, Alabama, where he had produced epochal hits for Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett. He also brought in two members of Dire Straits, guitarist Mark Knopfler and drummer Pick Withers. They managed to record the entire album in a mere 5 days. One time, Dylan was in an evangelical mood and thought he would proselytize me, Wexler said. I said, "Bob, you're talking to a card-carrying 62-year-old Jewish atheist. Forget about it." Songs like "Gotta Serve Somebody," "Precious Angel," "I Believe in You," and "Man Gave Names to All the Animals" stunned many fans, and even left longtime admirers like John Lennon in a state of shock. "All I ever think of is, don't follow leaders, watch the parking meters," Lennon said in 1980. "It's the same man, but it isn't the same man, and I don't want to say anything about a man who is searching or is found." The general public was more forgiving. The album shot to number 3 on the U.S. charts and won largely stellar reviews. "I feel like it's one of the finest records Dylan has ever made," wrote Rolling Stone's John S. Wenner. People would be less enthusiastic when it was revealed that Dylan would only be playing his new religious songs on his next tour, and that he had more to come. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Rolling Stone. Wanna see our pictures on-